from Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is the From the Bookshelf podcast. There's a new book about our 31st president, Herbert Hoover. It's the first book about him, written by an author without an agenda. Charles Rapley, author of Robert Morris, Financier of the American Revolution, and Sons of Providence, The Brown Brothers, The Slave Trade, and the American Revolution, did not want to prove that Hoover was a great misunderstood leader or condemn him as the man who drove the country off a cliff. Charles Rapley only wanted to learn about the man and his administration. The result is Herbert Hoover in the White House, The Ordeal of the Presidency. Charles Rapley, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, hello, Gary. Thanks for having me on.
We hear a lot during this election season about the appeal of the outsider and the disdain for the politician. Which I always think is kind of funny. Like, well, if I was going to have my teeth drilled, I wouldn't say, you know, those dentists, they're all so dental. I'm going to go to the shoemaker and have my teeth drilled.
Anything but a dentist. Yes.
And Hoover was one of those. He had that same appeal. He was an outsider.
Well, that is actually, it's a hallmark of democracy, it seems like. There's always been a sort of aversion to people who, to the people who were, who voters could identify as yearning for office, as career politicians. People don't trust them. They assume that they're lying. They assume they'll say anything to get elected. And to some degree, that might be true. But it also is true that politicians have a sensitivity to the feeling of voters that perhaps we non-politicians don't share. Politicians tend to be better at achieving compromise. And at any rate, the instinct to revile the politician is not new. It's not something that we invented today. And it was something that was prevalent in 1928. This at the height of the Roaring Twenties, when public life was really getting kind of silly, both in politics and in general. People were tired of sort of excess and fad, and wanted something a little more sober and serious in their political leaders. And Herbert Hoover really fit the bill at the time.
Well, you know, we don't think of Calvin Coolidge as being like a wild and crazy guy. I mean, I think it was Dorothy Parker who said when she heard that Calvin Coolidge had died, how can you tell?
Yeah, well, and Hoover was an extension of the sort of normalcy that was on a lot of people's minds, the retreat to normalcy or the return to normalcy. And he was a natural Hoover, a natural successor to Coolidge. He was a Secretary of Commerce in the Coolidge cabinet. And, you know, he brought this very sober, restrained approach to campaigning. He made a total of 5 speeches in his campaign for the presidency and didn't give any press interviews in between, refused to speak to the reporters. And you have some reporters who I quote in the book who covered both Hoover and Al Smith, Hoover's rival in 1928. And Al Smith, mayor of New York and sort of a garrulous, typical politician, the reporters loved him. They loved traveling on his train. He was always talking. He was funny. He was very friendly. And whereas Hoover was removed and sort of stern and aloof, not available. But again, and remarkably, Al Smith was a great public speaker, generally considered at the time, and Hoover was a terrible public speaker, and that was the principal medium of campaigning at the time, was speeches. The only mass media was radio. And still, Hoover was the one who not only got the approval of the electorate, but won in a landslide. It was the biggest margin ever in any election to that date. Now, that's always a factor of, in part, that the electorate keeps growing, so each new president gets more votes than the last, by and large. But still, Hoover's was a landslide, He also succeeded in winning some states in the South, where the Republicans had not won any states in the Deep South since the Civil War. He was a consensus candidate or consensus leader who Americans believed would be the steadiest hand on the helm for the ship of state, and almost as if they were anticipating hard times ahead, and they wanted an engineer, a capable sort of practical guy, to be in charge, and that's what they got.
So there weren't 11 debates with Al Smith.
No, not a single one.
I guess that wasn't uncommon. People didn't debate as much then as they do now.
Well, not so much. I mean, there was the Lincoln-Douglas debates. Debates have come and gone in sort of the American political tradition. But no, these were separate campaigns. They didn't really encounter each other. And in Hoover's case, he never even mentioned Smith. He just talked about the prosperity that Americans had enjoyed all through the 20s. And, of course, Hoover was intimately involved with that as Secretary of Commerce, so he was able to claim some credit for the success of several Republican administrations in a row in helping America climb out of a brief post-World War I recession and into unprecedented prosperity. It didn't occur to anybody at the time that they were running up asset values in a bubble similar to the one we had going with real estate in 2008, and that they were heading for a historic economic crash, which is what turned out to be right around the corner.
So how old was Hoover when he became president, and other than being Secretary of Commerce, you know, what else had he done?
Well, Hoover had been a successful private mining consultant, and had enterprises all over the world, was a millionaire back when $1 million was a lot of money. He was a millionaire by the time he was 40, and he decided he wanted to go into public life. And he did so at first as with the arrival of World War I, he was in Europe at his London-based consultancy and took on the job of helping Americans who were caught in Europe by the outbreak of the fighting, helping them to escape Europe, providing them with money, documents, whatever they needed to get home. And after the immediate flush of the onset of the war, he became engaged in something called Belgian Relief, which was to supply food to the non-combatant civilian population in Belgium, which was caught between the armies of France and Germany and was caught without resources, without food. There was starvation breaking out. And Hoover took on this big humanitarian project. At one point, he had 600 ships sailing under his own personal flag, as a neutral, almost like a country, except it was just Hoover's neutral relief project. And it was recognized by the Navy, all the combatant navies on the seas. They allowed Hoover's ships to get through the blockades to bring food into Belgium. And it was considered the greatest humanitarian project of all time. And Hoover came to be known as the great humanitarian. So that by the end of World War I, he had emerged as a uniquely positive sort of character. He wasn't a general. He didn't involve himself in the killing machine that was operating on all across the face of the globe. Instead, he was a peacemaker. He was a humanitarian, and that's what brought him to public attention. Warren Harding, successor to Wilson in the White House. Warren Harding brought Hoover into the government as Secretary of Treasury, and then he died in the midst of the Teapot Dome scandal. Coolidge replaced him. Hoover stayed on as at Commerce. And when, in 1928, Coolidge announced that he would not seek another term in the White House, all eyes turned to Hoover. He seemed to be the consensus candidate. And the election bore that out, and he was into the White House. He won the first election he ever entered, and that was the election for the presidency.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf, and we're talking with Charles Rapley, whose new book is Herbert Hoover in the White House, The Ordeal of the Presidency. In your book, you describe the Great Depression in different terms than history has come to regard it. It was not the sudden crash of 1929?
Crash of 1929, the Wall Street crash, was a major event, but it was not that unusual. Markets come and rise and fall, and there are big crashes and little ones. This was no doubt about it, a big crash, but it was not immediately recognized that this would lead to a wholesale economic downturn. So I think one of the points I tried to make in the book, and I do so in pretty clearly in dividing the book into three parts, and the first part is called The Rise and Fall of Herbert Hoover. This places his downfall in 1930, and the point being that the Depression had only just set in, but in 1930, and Hoover was just a year into his presidency, but already he was considered to be a political failure. He had shown himself to be ill-equipped to manage a democratic system. All the hemming and hawing, the horse trading, the making friends with your enemies, all those niceties of political process, all of the politician's art, you might say, all of that escaped Hoover. And it was clear within a year, in the general sort of tone of the coverage and in the popular expression generally, Hoover was considered a failure. And this, I found that to be intriguing for a couple of things. First is that Hoover's failure as a president was not simply that the Depression came on. It was, again, going back to what we talked about earlier, that he was not a politician, and that if you're in a political job, it actually helps to be a politician, and being a non-politician can be a real problem for a president.
In what ways did not being a politician sink him?
Well, the episode that really struck people, or the proceeding that confirmed in a lot of people's minds that Hoover was not right for the job, was the debate over the tariff. And for Americans today, it all sounds very foreign. But at the time, what we call protectionist today, protectionist economic policy was the law of the land. And Americans protected domestic industry with high tariffs for all kinds of industrial competition from abroad. The idea was that we would sustain American wages, sustain American producers by keeping prices higher here so that foreigners couldn't compete and so that Americans could at least enjoy a secure home market. Today, that's all been erased with free trade policy and a free trade sort of ideology that says that, well, markets are better when they're open, that Americans do well in open competition, and our policy objectives are always towards open markets. Well, in those days, Democrats were experimenting with open market as a new sort of philosophy that they were pushing. Republicans were the defenders of protectionism, quite the opposite of what we have today. And when Hoover came into office, what he wanted to do was to promote American agriculture. Agriculture had always been the sort of poorer stepsister of the American economy, at least since the turn of the century, the turn of the 20th century. And Hoover's first objective on getting into office was to revive and protect American agriculture, and the first way he wanted to take that on was to introduce tariff protection for American agricultural products alongside industrial protection, which was already well underway. So he introduced, when he became president, he called a special session of Congress to deal with agriculture, and particularly through the tariff. As soon as he did so, it opened up into what is to be expected in tariff debates like that, which is sort of a feeding frenzy. Every industrial interest in the country coming before the Congress and saying, I need more protection. I'm making thumbtacks, and the thumbtacks are cheaper in China because they don't pay people enough, so we need more protection for our thumbtack factory. Hundreds and hundreds of different types of products got their own hearings under the tariff hearings in this special session of Congress, to the point that the senators in Hoover's party were coming out and saying, this is not what the president had in mind. This is inviting the whole spectrum of tariff debate to take place here and to dominate this session of Congress when it's supposed to be agriculture that we're talking about. We are advocating for limited tariff revisions. That's what Hoover said he wanted, and that's what we should be doing. And they got up and they made their speeches, and then they looked to the White House for somebody to say something to back them up. And Hoover was silent. He said nothing. People would go to him and appeal to him to enter the fray. He held back. He said, this is not the purview of the White House. Legislation is reserved for Congress. We're going to wait and see what comes out. And this went on for months. And again, elements of the tariff debate would come back to the White House, and the White House had nothing to say. And it got to the point that people started saying, what is wrong with this president? Why doesn't he address these things? There were a number of other issues where Hoover also sort of held back, failed to engage, didn't support his backers, didn't punish his enemies, all the standard sort of stuff that you expect in the game of politics. Hoover wasn't playing. And as a consequence, even some of the writers who had been supporting Hoover all along started to wonder. And then in June 1930, Walter Lippmann, the great sage American journalist at the time, the sort of original pundit, Walter Lippmann came out with a major cover story on a national magazine asking the question, or posing the question, of the peculiar weakness of Mr. Hoover, and exploring the idea that on rational basis, in rational debate, Hoover excels, but in the rough and tumble business of politics, he proves to have this, what he called the peculiar weakness, the declining to engage, the holding back at the point of conflict. This was diagnosed as a character flaw, but also as a hallmark of his new presidency, and the reason that there didn't seem to be a there when it came to the White House. So you had, just as the onset of the Depression, really a crippled president in the White House trying to manage. It set the stage for what turned out to be another 3 years of really an ordeal in the White House.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. We're talking with Charles Rapley, and his new book is called Herbert Hoover, The Ordeal of the Presidency. That criticism of not doing enough is something that lots of presidents have been faced with since Hoover.
Since Hoover and before Hoover, and it's it's interesting for me to be reading some of Hoover's critics at the time. They sounded a little like the critics of Obama and some of the other people that we've seen come and go, where they said, you know, whether it works or not is up to how he might go about it is up to the individual in the White House, but the measure of a presidency is how successful they are in bending Congress to their will. Now, you can say that, well, some people have a tougher Congress to deal with than others. That certainly looks like the case with Barack Obama. But back there in 1930, they were talking about the same thing, that Hoover couldn't seem to get what he wanted out of Congress, and that was the signal that this presidency was not working out.
And had he been a better arm twister, he might have gotten more done.
Well, that was the theory, and you know, it is tough to, you look at what Obama had to deal with and what he did, you know, did he fail to twist arms hard enough, or did he get all that he could out of a certain, you know, recalcitrant factions in Congress? It's really hard to say one way or the other, but there is that element that Washington got done what he wanted, that Lincoln got done what he wanted, that FDR got from Congress the things he needed, enough to lay claim to leading the country through these dark times. When it comes to the presidency, it's not how you do it, it's whether you are able to bend the Congress to your will, and at least in this estimation and on that score, Hoover was a failure, like as you say, a number of others over the years. Those that everybody acknowledges as successful presidencies actually come down to a pretty small number, and that is one of the things they have in common, is that the president dominated the political scene at the time.
So, could Hoover have prevented the Depression, and could he have halted its spread or shortened its duration?
Well, that is the key question, and I think on that score, then I come back, you know, I've the first part of the book is talking about what a failure Hoover is. I think when it comes to policy and what he was confronted with and how he fared with it, I think Hoover does better than he is given credit for. The short answer to your first question, could he have done, or did he do enough to stop the Depression? I mean, there's two answers. No, he didn't do enough, but could anybody have? I'm not sure the answer is anything but no. In other words, that was a horrible circumstance that he was faced with. It plunged the nation into 10 years of severe unemployment, extending well beyond the end of his term. Could he have done anything to stop that? I don't think so. The collapse that he ran into was, as I mentioned earlier, was historic. Nobody had ever seen anything like it. Part of it was that the economy was bigger and more complex in 1930 than anything that had ever come before. And in fact, that process has been continuing, so that if, for example, we encounter what we have been threatened with and what we've been staring at now for a while, and it seems to have been abated, but let's just hope that's the case. If we run into an international credit freeze today, the collapse could be even larger and more extensive and more pervasive and harder to root out than the Depression. Because the economy is that much more complicated, that much more integrated, that much more sophisticated today than it was in 1930, just as in 1930 it was that much more sophisticated, more integrated, more complicated than it had been 30 years before. And so the Depression of 1930 was that much deeper. Anyway, so this is what Hoover confronted. Nobody'd seen anything like it before, and the precedents in front of Hoover, what had happened in prior depressions and recessions in America, the federal government had never taken a direct hand. It was always considered that this was not the business of government, this was the business of business, that government should stay out of economic problems because they didn't really know how to fix them, and it was not the affair of government. That was just life. Hoover was the first chief executive to encounter an economic setback like a depression or a major recession, and acknowledged that, in fact, there was a role for government involved in responding to it, and try to fashion a systemic federal response to an economic crisis like that. And he arrived at, he did develop a policy of intervention. He got there fairly slowly. He didn't like the idea of federal government taking a role in national economic affairs like this. But his hand was forced because of the depth of the Depression and the duration. He tried to ignore it for a while. He tried to rally the private interests of the country to reinforce their employment, to maintain consumer spending so that we could ride this thing out, but it didn't take. And Hoover recognized a couple of things that I think are quite interesting. One, it was that at the time there was a growing consensus in America and around the world that this was a death knell for capitalism, that this meant that capitalism didn't work and economics required central planning. And of course, the Soviet Union had had its revolution in 1918 and 1919, and in the years afterwards started running its economy based on five-year plans. And the whole idea of five-year plans became very popular in the U.S., and everybody was calling for new plans for a centralized economy. Mm. And Hoover rejected all of that and said that this crisis is not a death knell of capitalism, it's a test of capitalism, but that these ideas of central planning were anathema to private enterprise, individual enterprise, and that he was convinced that that's where growth and development come from, and that he would not put the U.S. into a planning mode, but would maintain free enterprise as the engine driving the U.S. economy. Interesting, challenging sort of viewpoint, refusing to go along with the tide of history that was sweeping Italy and Germany and South America into either communist or fascist camps. Hoover held out as a citadel of capitalism. And the thing that really struck me was his as insightful. At a time when a lot of people were sort of throwing in the towel, Hoover saw it not as a death rattle for capitalism, but he saw the Depression as a crisis of credit. And it was true that with the falling incomes, the value of the dollar actually rose. That's what happens with deflation. Everything, commodities lose value in the face of the rising dollar.
Yeah, money bought you a whole lot more then.
Money bought you more. Debts became harder to pay because money was, that you were paying back dollars that were worth more than the dollars you had borrowed.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole credit market started to freeze. Also, when assets are, particularly like real estate assets, which we're familiar with, which you start to realize that when it turns out that those real estate assets are overpriced, then the banks who hold mortgages on their books, they find that those mortgages aren't worth what they used to be. That's what we call frozen assets. And the banks of the United States were swept by an asset freeze, a huge asset freeze, and found that their portfolios weren't worth what they were booked at, and people started going to banks and demanding their money, and there was runs on banks, and the banks couldn't answer them, and there was a huge rash of bankruptcies, and this was a paralysis of credit, and Hoover recognized it as such, and he created something called the Reconstruction Finance Corp. Once he recognized that this credit crunch wasn't going away, he established a federal agency to float beleaguered banks with federal loans. Sounds a lot like the TARP program. In fact, it was a forerunner to the TARP program, but it anticipated TARP by 80 years. And it ran into the same criticism as TARP. People called it the billionaire dole, and they couldn't understand why Hoover would endorse funding, federal funding for banks, but not federal funding for unemployment insurance or some of the other new ideas that people were talking about at the time.
Right. In other words, he was willing to help the rich folk, but he wasn't willing to help everyday folk.
Well, that was the critique. In his mind, he was willing to help employers and institutions stay in business so that, you know, they could keep people working and keep the economy moving. And but he had to take all the heat of being, you know, the billionaire dole and being caring more about corporations than about people. Hoover never minded taking political heat, but it didn't help him that he was so inept in defending himself and explaining himself. He drew a lot of animosity for those years of saying no to food banks, that those should be handled locally, that there was no federal role in these emergency aid projects, that was a local and state concern. He fought a rear guard action to try to keep the government out of direct aid, and he failed that way. That's what got him voted out and got Roosevelt voted in. But when it came to what was wrong with the economy, how to fix it, I think Hoover demonstrated real insight and ought to get credit for understanding the situation better than almost anybody around him, and devising a program that took too long to start bearing fruit for him to get credit for it. But the Reconstruction Finance Corp that he launched under his administration and funded with $2 billion in credit, which is half the federal budget at the time, a huge number for 1930, that continued under Roosevelt's administration and was probably the most instrumental single government entity in bringing about the ultimate end of the Depression.
So if Herbert Hoover had in fact been a better politician or a more experienced politician, he might have not necessarily ended the Depression any earlier or prevented it, but at least he might have even been reelected, or he would have gotten more credit for what he had accomplished.
Well, I think... Yes, I think if he had political tools in his kit, I think he would have been more effective. And if he had brought the same analysis to bear on the Depression, but had been more successful in explaining to people what he was doing, and reassuring them of his engagement and his concern, I think he could have. I think it would have fared a lot better. I do.
Well, there's certainly a lot more to be found in this book, Herbert Hoover in the White House, The Ordeal of the Presidency, and I hope that you will come back and talk to us again, maybe when the book comes out in paperback. But Charles Rapley, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Well, Gary, I get a little long-winded on this stuff, but I do think it's quite interesting, and I hope your listeners get a sense of what's so compelling about Hoover and his story. And I really appreciate the time. Thank you, Gary.
that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf podcast. Thanks for coming to FromTheBookshelf.com and come back again next week to hear another show. In the meantime, you can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook, and you can hear us live every Monday on KSCO Radio in Santa Cruz. I want to thank my guest, Charles Rapley, his book, Herbert Hoover in the White House, The Ordeal of the Presidency. From the Bookshelf podcast is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.